Let's just finish up on the prison image on 262. She's kind of given us two different ways to understand it, but really the same. But one, which I just mentioned, which is what she talks about right after the quote, about extracting from alchemy, extracting the soul from the mineral body. That's an alchemical way of putting it. And so that the soul would be imprisoned in the material body, which would mean that the meaning is imprisoned in the experience. That's what I just talked about. Another way she talks about it, which is pretty much saying the same thing. 262, I'll just read you the second paragraph. Psychologically, the alchemical unlocking of the iron would mean the emotional release of the ego caught in its prejudices and caprices. Now, how does that, is that not a contradiction that one says that the meaning that's in prison and the other says that the ego that's in prison? No, because when the meaning is in prison, it's because the ego is imprisoned in its prejudices and can't hear the meaning that's imprisoned in the experience. I think that's the link between the two. So in one sense, the imprisonment is that the experience, the meaning of the experience is not available. And the other meaning of imprisonment is that the ego is not in a position to receive it. So that prison image, again, the reason I'm kind of focusing on it a bit, because it really is so common in our work. Mm. And it generally goes along with a very disagreeable feeling. These dreams, when what these images refer to is not pleasant. It's when your work is beginning to have an effect on you. The inner work is beginning to have an effect on you. And you feel trapped by it. Maybe you don't want to go home and have the fight with the spouse. Maybe you don't want to commit to a course of study, you know. Maybe you don't want to stay in the evening and deal with what you're feeling rather than going out and going to a movie or something like that. That's how it's often felt. So contact with the unconscious opens the prison we have made for ourselves, I'm just reading on, with our conscious views and our ego-bound aims. At the same time, an analogous process takes place in the unconscious psyche. Through the application of conscious insight, the unconscious is freed from its irreducible, unchanging quality and is altered by contact with the understanding consciousness. Next image. You okay with that? It's not complicated. Also, shall also move my candlestick out of its place and shall break asunder the chains of the prison of darkness. So, in other words, one of the images of Sophia is candlelight. Remember the dream I told you about the guy with the erection and his penis was a candle? That's pure Sophia. It's a natural light. So the light, the candlelight, would be the meaning, which we're trying to release. Here it's just described as in another image. If you want to get a little bit more complicated, the text says, move my candlestick out of its place. And she says, that is a revelation to 2.5. Or else I will come unto thee quickly and will remove thy candlestick out of his place, except thou repent. It is to be assumed that this had happened before the parable began, and that as a punishment, her candlestick was removed to hell for which reason the anima now asks for it to be restored. You follow that logic? It's following up the implications of the biblical amplification. It doesn't say anything new, but I think it does give an image to what we've been talking about. What does it mean that that candlestick has been removed to hell? Can you say a little more? Historically, how did that work?
The imprisoning of instinct?
Yeah, exactly. Through, I think it's always helpful to keep Jung's basic ion argument in mind, which is that spirit and instinct were once, I can't say united, might be better to say conglomerated in late antiquity. That is, instinct was lived freely, and it was felt to have a numinous aspect about it. The purity of Christianity had not entered into Western civilization yet. But the problem was the ego wasn't strong enough to handle it. So the psychological accomplishment of Christianity is that it separated spirit from instinct. And it said spirit is good, instinct is bad. It split. The advantage was it gave people support on the side of spirit so that they could control instinct. And Jung felt if that hadn't happened, we would have literally burnt ourselves up. So it was a necessary error, you might say. And so this great vertical emphasis throughout Christianity, where the monasteries are just, you know, way up, is so graphically illustrative of the fact that the spirit tries to get people above the earth instinct. And so that would be the putting of the candle into hell, because instinct was labeled bad, and therefore its spiritual capacities were likewise disowned, and that again was necessary. But it has gotten to the point now where that repression is so effective, it itself is a problem. Because the repressed instinct has been neglected for so long, it's just hungry. And it's going to get its way one way or the other. That is how Jung understands the breakdown of our values today. Our spouses almost sell each other. I mean, it's the disgusting sitter I see and hear how people treat each other. Everything is for sale for a short-term goal. That's why I like this movie so much. You can see how it was before that happened. People actually cared for each other. What a shock. However, as I said, the solution is now a problem, and the way to bring instinct back in is not simply to let it have its play again, but to accept it, knowing it's the vehicle for spiritual experience. That's what it would mean to take the candle out of hell. And that's what it would mean historically and in an individual's life. What we're each trying to do is recover our own instincts, not repress these experiences that hit us like we were instructed for 2,000 years, also not to live them out irresponsibly as the Romans did. but to really try to forge a new relationship to instinct, where, yes, we allow it to come up in its disorganized and disconcerting state, but then we try not to act it out, but get an image for it. That image, when understood, and calms the instinct. So that, again, is getting the candle out of hell. So, you know, in our work, we're not just trying, I probably said this, but I'm going to say it again, we're not just trying to help people get over their personal problems, we're helping them trying to get over their personal problems in a way which is relevant to the demands of this historical time. That's why Jung went off to all that trouble to understand the psychology of this historical time in the context of Western civilization, and then develop a psychotherapeutic method, bad choice of words, method, but let's use it anyway, psychotherapeutic method, that tries to heal people in the way that the historical perspective says is so badly needed. That's why he was so interested in history. And I think all that is implied in that little image of the candlestick out of its place. You hear that?
Hey, just one question about the, you said you work with the image, and then when the image is understood, it gives a form of guidance?
Well, two things happen. It gives the ego a guidance, but it calms the instinct. As if to say what that instinct was asking for all along was not for its blind satisfaction, but to be understood. So with it, getting the image out of the instinct strangely satisfies the instinct. And it changes. This is part of Jung's thought that spirit is at least as powerful a, we don't really have a word for it, let me say drive, as instinct. It looks like you're in the grips of instinct. But when you see the image and you feel the instinct change, you realize there's something else going on besides instinct. Although it sure as heck feels like instinct. Mm. However, to get to that spirit, you sometimes have to go through the instinct. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you can just spiritualize yourself.
Right.
You have to live out the instinct. Mm. So can you see how he's trying to bridge the two together? Spirit and instinct.
Can you say that it allows the instinct its intention?
Absolutely. That the instinct does have an intention.
And that's what you're
allowing
to surface.
You don't get it if you live it out blindly. You don't get it if you only want the intention. You have to go through it to get to the intention. At least go through some aspect of it. So this is not a way to avoid cooking. It's the cooking leading to
you
it.
You have to stay in the presence of the instinct.
You have to stay in the presence of the instinct until it yields up. Yes. You have to stay in the presence of the instinct in the right way.
Right.
Before it yields up its meaning. I thought that that story of the guy in the picture was just classic. And I myself have experienced it with sexual transference and kind of transference. The moment the meaning is understood, the feelings change. And I mean from one second to the next. You're sitting there thinking, oh my God, I think I'll throw away my whole career because she's what I want. And next minute it's gone. When it's understood. And what remains is a genuine friendship. Every woman I've been through this with in my practice, we've remained friends. We stay in touch. Not how you doing every Friday, but Christmas cards or, you know, call now and then. Yeah, and you can see how Eros then develops out of sexuality. So that the intent in that case would be Eros. I think it's beautiful what Jung has done here. Another phrase which we talked about at the very beginning, and it should be familiar still, so I'll just refer to it. The lumen naturale, or scintilla, do you remember? Bottom of 263. I'll give you a hint. I put it in the study guide on pages 35, 38, and 42. It's just another word for candlestick. Remember what they were? What was the lumen that drew out? The light of nature.
What was the light of
nature? What is it, yeah. I mean, it was in the sense it's a medieval concept. And how does it relate to Jung's psychology in general?
Well, we saw here Jung's...
Well, even a little more structurally. In Jungian psychology, what?
Well, indwelling the drive to wholeness.
Can you be a little more specific?
A pattern is formed within you?
Yeah. And what is the pattern?
It's the Sophia.
It's the archetype. Yeah. I'm just trying to get you to use Jungian words here, which generally I don't do. But for him, remember we talked about the numinosity of the archetype? That this pattern, this capacity to produce images, which he calls the archetype, has an intelligence. It knows what image needs to be generated. It knows sometimes years, decades in advance what you need. It is astounding. I think I told some of you this when I was when we did the Nietzsche course. I went back and just looked through my years. 1974, I dreamt I would be teaching a course on Nietzsche. And I had not ever thought of that again. It just so that shows you how far in advance the unconscious is, and that is a light. See, that's the understanding of the unconscious. And in medieval philosophy, it was thought that there was a light buried in nature. And Jung is saying that's the same thing I'm talking about. In our physiology is this capacity for understanding, and that is what he calls the luminosity of the archetype. And the other way it's described in other medieval representations is that there are little sparks embedded all around the universe, and that's the scintillae. And that's very close to stars, starlight. So starlight, candlelight, the luminosity of the archetype, they're all just different images for the same thing. But what that means is when it comes up in a dream is that we stop and we don't ask ourselves, as we often do, I wouldn't ask some of the dreamer, well, what do you want? You see, it's not about what you want. It's what does the unconscious want? And with the assumption that it has a knowledge at least as good as your knowledge. And so our job is to become quiet and to hear that. And then to have the faith that we don't have to come up with all the answers. Some of the answers are already there. We just have to listen to them. Be still enough and listen to them. That is what it means to me that the archetype is luminous. That's what the light of nature is. That's what the scintillae are. That's what the candle is.
So then we're descending into hell so that aspect can be resurrected.
So that the light can shine. We have to be dimmed so it can shine. Yeah. So she's being asked for her candle to be released, and then she says, and then she wants her hungry soul fed. 264, and feed my hungry soul, which hasted in thirst for his face with the fat of wheat and with the honey out of the rock. So that brings up the image of honey. Right. I think she sums it up well, 265. Honey is the loving attention of the conscious mind. So 265, the end of that first paragraph. I skipped a couple words, but I'm just trying to hit the main point. Honey is the loving attention of the conscious mind. In other words, nothing is as... You see it? 265, the first paragraph, the three lines up from the bottom. First one says, mind, anima, to Paracelsus. 265. Before the quote, there's a line that starts with mind, and the line that starts with anima. See it, everybody? Mm-hmm. And then to Paracelsus. Honey signifies, and I just skipped it a little bit to make it, let me just read the whole thing. Honey signifies the sweetness of the earth. The anima is joyless and needs the loving attention of the conscious mind. I think that it was simply the pouring energy into your dreams. Pouring energy into...
It says it's about the attention of the conscious mind. Wouldn't there be some... Well, yes, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The attention of the conscious mind to the unconscious. The unconscious experiences as sweet.
Wouldn't it be too, Gary? I mean, yes, the dreams, absolutely, but living with intention, living your day-to-day life with as much intention as you can.
But intention, depending on how you mean intention, I guess.
Well, to respond to what your dreams are telling you,
yeah.
What your
right.
how you want to live your life in a different way,
yeah.
You know, to not get sucked into this world out there in the way that we usually do.
Yeah, and that's the sweetness of the earth. Mm-hmm. It's really sort of tragic when you talk to people who have had what we call a negative mother complex, who were never given anything. I could tell you some stories that would turn you upside down, but such people will often say, I was never given anything. I got ripped off, which was true. But if you watch them, they also cannot give themselves anything in the present moment. When I say, write up your dreams, bring them to me every week, get here on time, they can't do it. They cannot give to themselves. And they go through life bitter, feeling they don't get things from others, but they don't give anything to themselves. And you can watch it happen right in front of me. Just that ability to show up regularly, to write down your dreams, to reflect on your dreams, is actually food for the soul. And I think that's what she's saying she's asking for. Pay attention to the inner. And you have to kind of put yourself in, if you can, put yourself in the position of the unconscious. Imagine you are your unconscious. I don't know if you can do that or not. Mm-hmm. Try it. Imagine you're inside yourself. You're not here looking, but you're inside yourself looking out. When you, the conscious personality, are paying attention to that world, it feels that the outer world is being kind to it. And therefore, it will respond in kind with its own kindness. It's when that inner space feels nothing is being given to it every day that it feels that the world is a cold place.
So when you experience the honey or something that's a sweetness, then your soul is being fed.
Your soul is being fed. Right.
That's beautiful.
I think it is beautiful. And it's the only, I mean, it's, I can't say it's only, it's the way we understand you work through traumatic childhood. The past is over. Give it up. And now, look at how you repeat that past by giving yourself nothing. or giving yourself everything but that attention to the inner world. You may have a big car, you may have a big house, you may have a Rolex watch, but if I say write down your dreams and come on time, that is too much. Because you can't give to yourself. And then you have to have a bigger car and a bigger watch, because that soul is hungry, and you think the soul will be happy with all that external stuff, and it's not. Yes, you need external stuff to be comfortable. I'm not stupid. But this drive for materiality and prestige is power, and power is often of a soul that's getting no honey. And the people will dream of dried up women or dried up animals or things like that. It's amazing then to watch when that happens. The next thing you get is, or a very often image that you get is, we'll look at 265, for they shall gather me together out of all the countries that they may pour upon me clean water. Now, the water would be another image for the honey, the living water. How about gather me out of all countries? Now, that is an image from what tradition? Gnosticism. You see how that is a Gnostic image? And what does that mean in this case?
You mean psychologically?
Yeah,
or?
How would you psychologically interpret that?
All the parts of the personality together?
Yeah, and how do we gather them?
I mean, other than by working our butts off.
In what way do we have to work our butts off?
Drink more.
Yeah. Well, looking at all the experiences that come to you in life and the emotional reactions that they produce, and then looking at the light inside those emotional reactions and finding what piece of yourself is contained in that experience. That is collecting the light. And that is rebuilding Sophia, you might say. And that is tantamount to feeding the soul with honey or washing the soul with water.
I was a little confused here where she talks about the Unitarian man who, and then she says, who is without stain.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the next page she says the Unitarian man is the anthropos. Here in the middle. But the anthropos is not a figure without stain, it's the total man. I'm not sure what she's getting at.
Yeah, let me see. Well, the anthropos is, that is the word, I'm not sure where it comes from, probably medieval theology, I think. Maybe it's, I don't know, that's a good question where that comes from. But anyway, it is referred to basically, it's the word used to refer to Adam. And, so Adam would be the... you see where we are?
Mm-hmm.
No. 265. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines down. I'll just read the whole... right after the quote. The first thing to be noted here is the motif of gathering together out of all the countries, an allusion to the gathering of light particles or the soul particles of God, which are scattered throughout matter. Okay, that's what I just talked about. How you do that by looking at the experiences in life and then finding the meaning. And that is the gathering the light. And that is the rebuilding of the self. The aim is to produce the unitary man who is without stain.
Now, is this the Christian idea? The idea of the Christian fathers? Because it's not an alchemical idea that he's without stain.
I don't know.
She loses me. What she's referring to, I guess.
It's me that would be the cosmic Christ, you know, that would be that Christ energy.
person. Not that thing of not referring to like the Catholic version of original sin, being that original.
No. I don't think. I'm not sure, to Kyle's question. I think you could probably find this idea both in alchemy and in medieval theology, but I'm not sure.
It did not go all the way back to Greek, the idea of the anthropos.
It must, because it's a Greek word.
To Thosimus or something.
Anyway, I don't know. I'll check on it, see what I can find. It's a good question. But let me just try to give you at least my basic understanding. The anthropos means original man. It's like anthropology. It's the same. Anthro. And Adam would be the anthropos. And Adam would be like the primeval man. Instinctual primeval man. And it's the anthropos is like what we would call the unconscious self. It's everything is there, but it's in a jumbled mess. It's a primitive person who is whole, but not consciously whole.
This would be the original state of our. Instinct?
The original state of a person who's living their instincts. Well, the Christian church, he says that's sinful. Because when Adam gets thrown out of the paradise, that's the recognition of sin. And the alchemical process tries to recreate that anthropos. As a second Adam. So there's a first Adam and a second Adam. And the second Adam would be Christ, or like Christ. So Adam is the first anthropos, Christ is the second anthropos. Now that doesn't quite fit, but because Christ is shadowless. But what they're trying to get at is that there are two levels of wholeness. There's an unconscious level of wholeness, where people are not split, but they're also not aware. And there is a conscious level of wholeness where you're not split, but you are aware. And what we're trying to get to is the second level. That would be the conscious self. So to be, yeah.
That's the idea in alchemy.
Yeah, Okay. Yeah. And I think you could probably find church fathers that would talk about Adam as the first anthropos, Christ as the second anthropos. But the alchemists talk about it in a way which, of course, is a little closer to our understanding, that second Adam is also a synthesis of matter and spirit, where I think the Christian understanding would be that second anthropos is more pure spirit. Now, without stain, again, I think you could probably find both alchemical and Christian understanding of that, but probably with a different twist. The without stain for the Christian would mean without sin. Without stain for the alchemist would mean totally conscious. In our language, now to try to put this in Jungian language, and I think then it may help, that the first anthropos would be the unconscious self. Children, for example. That's childhood paradise. And I can say the most brilliant things, but the next moment they're talking about poop or something. And there is wholeness because there's no division, but there's also no consciousness. And the shadow is lived out irresponsibly. The reason there's wholeness is because nothing bothers it. Sooner or later, that paradise comes to an end, and you start to become conscious, which means you are in a condition of self-division. That is endured, which means that there we in an individual goes through in their own life what Western civilization went through in the last 2,000 years. There's a split. And there's this attempt to control oneself. Meanwhile, there's no Anthropos around. That's been long gone. But what we try to work for then is a conscious self in which there is an awareness of individuality, there is an awareness of instinct, an acceptance of instinct, a willingness to work with instinct and be transformed by it. There is a responsible ego present. There is a person who is created that is the person that was meant to be. When that happens, the instincts are no longer adversarial. That by hearing the intent of the instinct, they come into harmony. I told you that famous story, famous not joking, about the Vermont truck driver. I tell you that when I moved back here, I moved back here from Vermont. A local guy from Vermont moved me back. And it was right around race time. And he had to get help from a local guy to help him unload the truck. And so they were unloading the truck, and the local guy says to the Vermont guy, are you going to go to the race? And the guy says, no. He says, oh, you ought to go. He says, you ought to see the women. And they even show you their tits. The Vermont guy turned to me and said, that's great. You see, that's somebody whose instinct is no longer adversarial because he's accepted the larger dimension of relationship and love and sex and his partner. But for the local guy, those instincts are still antagonistic. They're ready to break out at any time in an inhuman, in an unfeeling way. Well, that's just a small example, but that's the sort of alignment that comes as the self becomes conscious. That split with the instinct breaks down. And there's a harmony. Because they don't have to shout anymore. Their intent has been heard. And that is then the creation of the second anthropos, the conscious self. Without stain in the sense that that guy was not impressed by seeing boobs of women he doesn't know and care about. That's, I think, what they mean by without stain. There is a purity of intent. Not that he has no shadow. But there is a purity of intent which is not present before a conscious realization to the self is established.
There's a wholeness.
And so there's a first wholeness and a second wholeness. Yeah. And why this is relevant here is because this Sophia experience is simply one way that happens. That you move from a state of unconscious wholeness to conscious wholeness. That then, Carol, is picked up again on 266. And you can see now, I think, Carol, your question is very helpful. Let me read you the quote on 266. That there may dwell in me the virtue of penetration and of liquefaction. Okay, so that's that she's going to go through a transformation. In the day of my resurrection, when I shall be glorified by God. See, she's back to Christ again. So, Thomas is equating the anthropos with Christ, the second anthropos with Christ, and that's the error. The second anthropos is not adequately described by the canonical image of Christ, because there is no relationship with the instinct. And there is no relationship to sexuality. There is no relationship to power. It's all spirit. Jung's feeling, that worked for a while, but it's now time to change our understanding of what the second anthropos is. Might be another way to put it. So you can see how this experience in Thomas is trying to produce a new concept of what the second anthropos is, to use this language now. But it never quite gets there because it stays stuck in Christ.
And so you're talking about Jesus Christ, the man, right? not.
They're talking about, think about the medieval representation of Christ.
That's not mine. I'm talking about the cosmic Christ. That resurrected at wholeness. The story is about the wholeness. Hmm. It's not about the man that lived 7 years ago.
Well, they're not talking about the man that lived either. They're talking about, I don't know how to say it, their image of Christ. Look at centuries of medieval art. Mm-hmm. There it is. Halo, pure, above, spiritual, almost anorexic.
And they've gotten stuck there and not allowed that to transcend.
And this experience is trying to get that to move past it. And we see how it keeps falling back into the original formulation. And I think we can, as pointed out several times, we can see that at the moment was maybe the only thing that can happen. But we now are being asked to carry it a step further.
So we're going to be the next step. I don't see it as either or here. As far as the Christ, leaving that, whatever that was, to move into that higher Sophia.
Yeah, hopefully I've been discussing it as the next step.
Right, that whole thing. It's not,
Have I not been doing that?
Right, except for I'm getting, I guess, as far as my, what I'm experiencing as far as the Christ transforming into Sophia, that Sophia always was, that type of experience is what, so transcending. So they're both the same, the higher version.
I don't think they're quite the same. I would say Sophia is the means whereby a new image of God is created.
Right. We're just seeing them different. That's all. That's okay.
Yeah. 267. The text then, see where I am about halfway down?
Mm-hmm.
The text then, this is just summing up. The text then says in sum, if the anima is gathered together, withdrawn from rejection of matter. Hopefully that we've said that enough times that makes sense. And washed with the spirit of wisdom and understanding. That would be the water. That would be the honey. Okay? Made conscious by insight, there will arise a spiritual entity which, like the risen Christ, can penetrate and pervade all material things. This new form of the anima is represented of as masculine. And it is that complete image of the self which is symbolized by the Phileus Philosophorum. That's a new thought.
What is Phileus? What does that mean?
I don't know.
Okay.
Well, let's try to approximate it. Let me go down a few steps.
Okay.
Previously, after the italics, previously, the anima image and the self were so contaminated that the first time the self crystallizes out of an independent content and met... Huh?
You skipped a sentence.
Oops. Mm-hmm. Previously, the anima image and the self were so contaminated that they could hardly be distinguished from one another. Now, for the first time, the self crystallizes out of an independent content and manifests itself as that more comprehensive center of the psyche, which, as we shall see, guides, big important word, guides, the anima impulse towards a definite goal, the individuation process. You don't try to put that in your own words.
Incest. Like the alchemical images of incest and stuff, the psyche redeems itself. It has to go back into itself.
Yeah, that's incest. But what does it mean that the anima is represented as masculine? What does it mean that the self crystallizes out as an independent content.
It's recognized as itself the first time. You know, remember that the Gnostic idea was that we all have these God sparks in us, and what our job was to return them back to the light, leaving the darkness behind. And to do that, we had to totally overcome matter. Remember how they had people living certain ways, and people prepared their food, took care of all their instinctual needs so they never had to behave. So for the, what this is saying to me is that for the first time they're recognizing that that self is there. It's not just something that's being returned to God. It's the self
that's
being recognized there.
As I would try to put that in my own words, what comes out of the encounter with the Soviet experience is an insight. And that insight is symbolized as masculine. So that a level of consciousness is created out of this experience. And that is symbolized as masculine here.
Okay. A level of consciousness
is created. A new level of consciousness is created. So when you withdraw the meaning out of the experience, you are the person who is aware of that meaning. And that awareness of that meaning, that state in you that is aware of that meaning, is symbolized by masculine.
And it's what is going to guide you.
And it becomes the guidance.
It's not this external God that's out there that you have to be in relation to in order to be guided.
It's what you
now is. So that spark that the Vanakians and Gnostics saw in us, now we recognize it's ourselves.
And when it becomes an insight, it's symbolized in the text as the shift to the masculine.
The shift to masculine.
And it's like what you called the intent. When that intent is known, that knowingness is described as masculine. Why that is, we talked about earlier. I don't know if we need to get into that. But in other words, a new level of consciousness is created. Is this making any sense? You see, what it does, it takes this experience and it just chops it up into the many varied aspects of the experience. Is that making sense? Okay. But I think the phrases that mean so much to me are the self crystallizes out. That's what I've been trying to say, that we pull the meaning from. And it's if you've ever done chemistry in high school or something, you know when you add a precipitate. Is that right? You add to a solution and it. When you add a catalyst to a solution and it precipitates. I think it's a pretty good image for what we're trying to do here. Something is plucked. Something is, it's like brought out of. And the other thing is that, which I think is so important, that it begins as an impulse, the anima impulse, or sexual impulse, aggressive impulse, depressive impulse, probably not the right word, but the depressive driven state. You're moved, and then out of that is a crystallization, and that crystallization is who you are. And that who you are is also the knowledge of where you're going. That's what she means, a definite goal. That's a lot, isn't it?
And that you are independent content. I mean, that is that's the self, that you are independent from all of the these relationships you thought you were participating in.
And determined by.
Right, and determined by, that you actually have self-agency.
Self-agency. It's the beginning of self-agency, and that agency is following an inner directive.
Right.
Yeah.
toward the individuation process. I
yeah.
found it so beautiful.
I thought she summed it up pretty well there.
Okay, and I don't mean to be redundant, but if I've had this relationship with Christ all this time, and I'm moving into the Sophia, which I have for like the last 9 years,
mm-hmm. and it's you personally have had your relationship with Christ?
Or yes. These people? Yes. No, my own, you know, my own personal experience. And but your masculine, is this the fact that the figure can deliver? You know, I mean, I've the masculine aspect of that shifting into the Sophia. I'm trying to kind of grasp a little bit as far as
you're asking.
I'm understanding basically what I've had Christ say to me like 6 years ago is that it's imperative that he leaves. So in order I can shift from this Christ that I had into, you know, and I really believe it's about that coming into the God, that image, embracing that aspect of God within me, that like the Christ within. It is the Sophia in me, that God in me. Does that make sense? I understand like vaguely kind of, and I just want to word it.
Think of it archetypally.
Pardon me?
Think of it archetypally, rather than with a name. Think of it as the energy.
Yeah, well, I do. Yeah, I mean, they all are just energy.
Or maybe it's such a deep thought we should pick up with it next time. Let this this sums up a lot of what we've said, and it might be good to come back and reread that last paragraph. Let it cook. I think you understand it intellectually. Like give your emotions some time to catch up with it, and then we can come back and work with that. So thanks again for your hard work. We are slowly making progress, and. I think I had you read to the end of chapter, which has the third paragraph, third parable. How big is the fourth parable? It's kind of long, isn't it? Yikes. Let's see. If you read... Actually, if you read to the middle of 287, I think that should be. We won't get that far, but you'll be a little ahead. 287. You read through 276, mm-hmm. So that's another 10 pages. Thank you, and I'll see you in the series.
Tonight.
And tonight,
oh, yeah.
If you're a glutton for punishment, I'll see you tonight.
Oh, yeah, we'll be there.